once considered the dummy of the class. Dr. Benjamin Carson is a perfect example of how someone can achieve greatness even when the cards are stacked against him. Born in the ghettos of Detroit, Michigan in 1951, Carson said that he was the, quote, most likely to end up in jail, reform school, or the grave. Poverty was a constant factor in his life. His father left home when he was very young, leaving his mother, a woman who managed to finish the third grade in school to raise two sons, Benjamin and his younger brother, Curtis. Ben struggled early in school. In an address to the student body at Johns Hopkins University, Carson jokingly referred to himself as the, quote, the safety net of his grade school class, which meant that as long as he was in the class, others had no danger of having the lowest grade. But his mom would not give up on her two sons. She insisted that her two sons, Ben and Curtis, write a book report every couple of weeks. This book report wasn't for school, it was for mom. And Carson dutifully obeyed. Well, about the time he was in junior high, he realized something quite shocking. And that is, his mother could not read. For years, he had been reading books and scratching out reports, assuming that his mom was checking every word, only to find out she didn't have a clue as to what he was writing. But Ben also discovered that the more he read, the smarter he became. And as time progressed, he moved from the bottom of his class to the top. After high school, he went on to Yale University and then to the University of Michigan's School of Medicine. And after graduation from medical school, Carson served as a neurosurgery resident at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Baltimore and was later named the hospital's director of pediatric neurosurgery at the age of 32. In 1997, he stunned the world by successfully separating a pair of Siamese twins who were joined at the back and at the head. A very difficult operation, given the fact that he did this in Africa with little modern medical equipment, an operation that spanned 28 hours. When asked as to who he owes the credit for his many, many accomplishments in life, Carson credited two major influences. First of all, God, his relationship with God. And secondly, his mother. It was his mother who gave her boys what she had, her interest, accountability, and courage. It was his mom who refused to bail out on him and his brother, who was committed first of all to God and then secondly to her two sons to raise them the best she could, who refused to give up but instead pushed her two sons. She understood the meaning of commitment and lived out her commitment to her sons. Years later, someone asked Ben why his mother still lived with him even after he was married and had a family of his own. His answer was simply this: you don't understand. If it wasn't for that woman, I wouldn't be living here. She earned this. Now, while sitting in the maternity room on Wednesday, waiting for my grandson Joshua to be born, I finished reading Dr. Benjamin Carson's book, America the Beautiful, in which he expresses his views of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And again, he gives the credit, first of all, to God, and then to his mother for the positive impact that he's had, that she had on his life. And just in case you missed it this week, he officially announced that he's seeking to become the next president of the United States, Dr. Benjamin Carson. Now, stories like this kind of tug at our hearts. Perhaps some of us could also tell similar stories of the love, support, and commitment of our moms, who refused to give up on us when we were young, who prodded and pushed, who gave whatever she had so that we might be where we are today. I know when I was a little boy, I hated school. The first grade, every day they took me to the bus stop wailing and crying. I didn't want to go. I would throw a temper tantrum fit. And for an hour before school started, I would sit in a rocking chair and just rock back and forth and say, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go to school. Just about drove my mom crazy. My mom one time told me that she thought I'd be a first grade dropout, that I'd never get. She was amazed that I went on to college and seminary because I just hated school. I loved it too much at home with mom. But my mom persevered. She didn't give up. She pushed. And we have fond memories of her cared deeply for us, for me. See, one in every two marriages today end in divorce. And while occasionally the husband has primary custody of the children, the vast majority of children today are raised by single moms. In fact, one out of six households in America are maintained by single moms raising children. Moms who willingly give of what they have to nourish and care for them. Moms who remain committed to their children, many of them sacrificing so that children can have a home and a good upbringing on this Mother's Day. They are to be commended. But for others of us, this story tugs at our hearts because we wish that our moms were more like Dr. Carson's. But the fact was, she wasn't. Some of you may have come from a home where your mom bailed out on you when you were young. You don't know the love of a mom. So Mother's Day is very hard for you emotionally. Now, for all of us, this story moves us to want the same kind of love, the same kind of commitment to our families and children as Mrs. Carson had. This morning, we're going to look at the life of a godly mother in the Old Testament who understood from experience what it takes in making and keeping a commitment to God. And my prayer is, as we look at the life of Hannah, and as we understand what God expects of you and I who have made commitments before Him, that we will be strengthened in our own commitments. Whether you're a mom or dad, whether you're single or married, the commitments we've made, that we'll be strengthened in our own commitments, will honor those in our lives who have kept their commitments, who have loved and cared for us, even though to do so might have been difficult. Now, I want us, first of all, to see the commitment that Hannah makes. And it's found here in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11. It says, "Then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Lord, if you give me a son, I'm going to give him back to you. He'll be yours. All the days of his life, he'll be yours. He will be a Nazarite from birth. No razor's ever going to touch his head. He will be set apart from birth for God's use and for God's glory." Now, that's quite a commitment that she makes. People today make promises. They make commitments that are, in the words of Mary Poppins, pie crust promises, easily made and easily broken. But was this commitment that Hannah made just one of these pie crust promises, one of these spur of the moment in the heat of the times, just to make a promise, a rash promise? How does she view commitments? And from her experience, what can we learn about commitments that we make before God? But I think, first of all, we'll find in this text that she believed that commitments are binding. That commitments are binding. That God expects that whatever we promise, whatever commitments we might make from our side, we're going to do our part to fulfill them. Before I administer vows in a marriage ceremony, I remind the couple of how seriously God views the vow they're about to make. In fact, I even give them an opportunity to back out at that point. Because I believe that God holds us accountable for the vows. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 4 and 5, he says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. If you make a commitment to God, he says, you better pay up. You better pay for it, for a failure to pay puts you in the fool's category. That is, a fool who says in his heart, there is no God. In other words, there is no God that's going to hold me accountable or responsible for the vow that I made, and so I can do whatever I want. But God does hold us responsible. God does hold us accountable. Vows or commitments that we make are binding. Now, Hannah understood that when she made this vow to God. She understood that the commitment that she was making would be binding upon her. And after God answers her prayer, she indeed gives her son. She follows through with this commitment. Now, many today take a much lighter view of commitment. People have all kinds of excuses as to why they should not and cannot keep the promises they made to God concerning marriage, concerning raising children, concerning anything in life. Excuses as to why they bailed out when the going got tough. They say, oh, we were so young. We were so young when we got married. We didn't know what we were getting into. But I'll tell you, even people that get old don't know what they're getting into when they get married. You know, but that's what we say. Well, I didn't know what I was doing and getting into when I went to the altar. We were naive. We were immature. We were not thinking rationally. Most people in love aren't. We were under a lot of pressure from others, from family, from friends. We weren't thinking of the long-term responsibility of parenting when we decided to have children. But now that reality has set in, now that we're wiser, we're more mature, now that the romance has worn off, the feelings have died, no more pressure from home or family. God, you can't hold us accountable. You can't hold us responsible for something we said in the heat of the moment or the commitment or vows we made when we were so young, so immature, so under duress, can you? But if there is anyone who was under stress or under duress when making a commitment, it was Hannah. Consider what's happening in her life at this time. Look at verse 1 of chapter 1. It says, now there was a certain man of Ramoth Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, first of all, we find here that Hannah was wife number two in a polygamous marriage. She is wife number two in a polygamous marriage. Now, may I say to you this morning, polygamy was never God's ideal for mankind. Jesus makes it plain what God designed for mankind was from the beginning when he states, according to Mark chapter 10, verse 6, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. That's God's ideal. From the beginning, God defines marriage and designed marriage to be one man, one woman, united together as one flesh until death do thee part. It was not one man and two women, as in polygamy, or one woman and two men as polyandry, but one man, one woman in monogamy. That is God's ideal. But you know, a divorce happens. Marriages fail, and I believe there are biblical reasons for divorce which allow for remarriage. And just as God permits divorce for certain reasons, God also allowed and even regulated polygamy in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 21, verses 15 through 17, sets down the stipulations regarding inheritance in a polygamous situation, where the son of the unloved woman is the firstborn, but the son of the loved woman is the secondborn, and you still got to give the firstborn his inheritance in that polygamous relationship. So while God does not outright condemn the practice, it certainly is filled with complications and unsavory results that are apparent in the Bible. One wife is generally loved more than the other, which causes all kinds of problems in the home, not only between the wives, but then also between the children. Remember the tension in Jacob's household between Rachel and Leah, between their sons, and then they also got their concubines involved in that, so there were like four women in that situation, and there were all kinds of problems. See, God knows that no house is big enough for two women. Just doesn't work. Polygamy certainly is not God's ideal. Now, it appears in our text that Hannah, at one point, had been wife number one. For her name is mentioned first, followed by the name of the other wife, Peninnah. But because Hannah had a problem, and that is, she was childless. She was childless. Peninnah had children. Hannah had none. Now, in Hannah's day, childlessness was considered a curse from God. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 13 and 14 reveals that the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb. You will be blessed above all people. There shall not be a male or female barren among you. The wife of the man who fears the Lord, who walks in his way, shall be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house, your children, like olive plants around your table. Thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. Now, they took verses like this and they drew a wrong conclusion. And that is, if you didn't have children, therefore something must be wrong with you spiritually. That there's got to be some sin in your life or something that for reasons God is withholding children from you. And that if you get your heart straight and life straightened out, then you're going to be blessed with kids. That's not true. But they certainly believe, and I believe too, that children are a blessing from God. So you can imagine the shame that Hannah must have felt. I mean, she was unable to conceive a child, and then they have this religious pressure placed upon her by people that perhaps were well-meaning, but thought that perhaps something was wrong with her spiritually because she couldn't have children. Her husband's hopes and dreams of perpetuating his name depended upon her giving him a son. And when that hope and dreams fade because of childlessness, many times in the Old Testament times, a man would marry another wife in hopes of having a son, an heir to his fortune. And that's what happens here. Because after Hannah was unable to conceive, her husband Elkanah married Peninnah and has children through her, thus confirming that the problem was not his, but it was Hannah's. She was barren. And thus she's no longer wife number one, but she now in the family structure, she becomes wife number two. But you know, in Elkanah's mind, Hannah is still wife number one. For look what happens, verse 4. It says, verse 3, this man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. He loved her. It was obvious that he did, for at the time of the annual offerings, he would give her a double portion. But you know, this ticked off the other wife. In fact, look what happened. Verse 6. And her rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Now you see the other name for Peninnah there, don't you? Rival. Rival. Some of the words that are used here, provoked her severely, made her life miserable, all because she was childless. She rubbed it in. She probably said, ha, 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 ha. I can have children and you can't. Ha, 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 ha. And so Hannah here is kind of caught in a love-hate triangle. Her husband, Elkanah, loves her, but wife number two, Peninnah, hates her. Now, see, you can feel kind of the tension, the frustration. She felt every day of her life, but especially on holidays and feast times when the family would go to Bethel to celebrate God's faithfulness and goodness. And at these festival times filled with family and food, Hannah couldn't eat. She was a basket case emotionally. The stress, the strain, the tension from this dysfunctional family was repressive. Now added on top of all of this, the fact that she's wife number two in a polygamous marriage, childless, caught in a love-hate triangle, is the fact that her husband did not fully understand her frustration. For look at what he says, verse 8. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Now, that's a typical left-brain logical male response to what's happening here. You know, and he's saying basically this, hey, toots, stop your crying. Why are you so bent out of shape of not having a child? You've got me. What more can you want? I'm much better than 10 sons. You know, when I read that in thought about that, it's like that Allstate commercial where the wife flaunts her safe driver's bonus check and the husband opens his mouth to speak and the narrator says, silence. This too is a time for Elkanah to keep his mouth shut. But you know he doesn't. He's really trying to comfort her, and instead of bringing comfort, it only accented her frustration that her husband does not understand the pain she's feeling. In fact, when Hannah makes her vow or commitment to the Lord, she's not in the best mental state. You look at verse 10. It says that she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. But there's more. Look at verse 11. Then she made that vow, verse 12, and it happened. As she continued praying before the Lord that Eli's the high priest, he watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, how long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you. And Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace. The God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Here's the high priest. He's the spiritual leader there in Israel. Her spiritual leader. He misunderstands and maligns her. He accuses her of nipping the bottle. In the middle of the day, being drunk. Prayer in the ancient times was out loud. It was audible. But here she is. Her lips are moving, but no sound is coming. And so he thought she was drunk, and drunkenness was not uncommon, especially at festive occasions, such as the Feast of Tabernacles or Pentecost. May I say to you, Hannah will not be the last person to be accused of being drunk in the middle of the day at the Feast of Pentecost, as the apostles would face the same in Acts chapter 2. But far from pouring herself too much to drink, she instead was pouring out her heart to God in fervent prayer. Now, I think you could see that Hannah could have built a really good case that the commitment that she made was under duress. She could say, man, I was desperate. And out of desperation, I cried to God and I made this commitment. But now that I'm calm, I'm thinking rationally, I'm unemotional, why must I keep that commitment that was made under such stress? And yet she does. She does, for Hannah understood that commitments made in the presence of God are to be kept. God holds us accountable. And commitments made before God are not only binding, but she also understood that commitment involves sacrifice. It involves sacrifice. There's a cost involved, a personal cost. Something must be given up in order to fulfill that commitment. We want commitments today that cost us nothing. That's one reason why marriages fail. Couples enter into marriage to get instead of to give. And marriage, they think, is a 50-50 partnership. But my friends, for marriage to work, as many of you know, it takes more than just 50-50. It takes each, the husband and wife, committed to giving 100% to that relationship. You know, that's one reason why abortion has become a favorite means of birth control today. Couples want the pleasure of sex without responsibility or commitment. And when many conceive a child, they don't want the child because the baby is viewed as an intrusion. It's going to ruin their life. And so they argue, why should I ruin my life because of this little baby? Why should I live the rest of my life caring for someone that I don't want? So instead of making that personal sacrifice to have the child, they sacrifice the child. We want commitments today that cost us nothing. Hannah's commitments personally cost her Samuel, her son. For the rest of his life, he's going to be loaned to the Lord, living away from home with Eli the priest, serving in the temple of God. Now, before you feel too sorry for her, and believe me, this story is a real tearjerker, put yourself in her shoes. Picture yourself taking your young son or your young daughter away to some church camp or Christian organization and dropping them off, knowing that you will see them once a year. I mean, that's hard. I know what it's like when I took my daughters to college and drop them off, knowing that they'll be home again. But, you know, it really tears at your heart to see your children go. But before you feel too sorry for her and for Hannah and for Elkanah, let me underscore that her commitment involved a willing sacrifice. A willing sacrifice. You see, she had another option. Turn in your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 27. Leviticus chapter 27, that's page 146 in the Pew Bible. Leviticus chapter 27, and you might want to keep your finger back here in 1 Samuel 1 because we'll be back. But Leviticus chapter 27, and beginning at verse 1. says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when a man consecrates by a vow certain persons to the Lord, according to your valuation, if your valuation is of a male, from 20 years old up to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver according to the shekel of the sanctuary. If it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. And if from 5 years old up to 20 years old, then your valuation for a male shall be 20 shekels, and for a female, 10 shekels. And if from a month old up to 5 year old, then your valuation for a male shall be 5 shekels of silver, and for a female, your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if from 60 years old and above, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for a female, 10 shekels. But if he is too poor to pay your valuation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall set a value for him according to the ability of him who vowed. The priest shall value him." Now there's an option here. And the option was is that they could have paid cash to redeem the child. According to 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 24, Samuel was handed over to Eli after he was weaned. A child in those days was usually weaned around 2 years of age. So Samuel would have fallen under the stipulation of verse 6, where it says that between 1 month and 5 years, the cost of redemption would have been 5 shekels of silver. Now, how much money is that? Well, a one sanctuary shekel was equal to 1 month's wages. So you figure it out, how much you make in a month, and then you multiply that by five. That's quite a large sum of money. But it is possible for redemption to have taken place. They could have paid cash and kept the child. But instead, they willingly chose to give Samuel to the Lord. You know, she gave her most precious possession in order to keep the commitment which she made to God. What are we willing to sacrifice in order to keep our commitments to God? See, one of the reasons we honor our moms today may be because of the willing sacrifice they've made to love and to care for us as children. For some of us, our moms chose to stay at home during our formative years to sacrifice perhaps their own careers or financial goals of the family in order to take care of our physical well-being. For others, our moms did not make that choice. Perhaps they could not because they had to work in order to provide food for our tables, put a roof over our heads. Perhaps others because they needed the stimulus of a career. But even though they may have worked outside the home, yet they somehow made time for us. They came to our games or our concerts. And even though they may have been bone tired when they came home from work, they somehow found the energy to still fix supper and have time for us. How they did everything, we don't know. But what we were sure of is that they paid a price. They willingly gave 100%, and we honor them for the sacrifice of their love and devotion. Now, a commitment made before God was not only binding and costly, but third, our human commitments are built on a more foundational commitment, our commitment to God. Hannah beautifully expresses her commitment to God in a prayer that's recorded here in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Follow as I read, beginning of verse 1. It says, "And Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumbled are girded with strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren have borne seven, and she who has many children has become feeble. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the beggar from the ash heap to set them among the princes, makes them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillar of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. From heaven he will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. If I could summarize, she simply says this: Lord God, you are sovereign. You are my God. You are holy. There is none like you. You know everything. You humble the proud. You exalt the humble. Lord, you are my protection, my help, my shield, my rock in this life. And in you I am putting my trust. See, Hannah committed herself first to God, for then and only then she had the ability and strength to fulfill the commitment that she made to God. It was out of that her commitment of herself to God that she was able to fulfill that commitment of giving Samuel over to the Lord. Perhaps this morning you and I are struggling with our commitments that we've made. Commitments are made to our spouse or our family or our children or even to our church family. And underlying that struggle is a foundational struggle of our commitment of our lives to Jesus Christ. Viewing him and obeying him as the Lord of our lives. Paul puts the commitment very simply in these words in Romans 12:1 when he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. That's the foundational commitment to God, a commitment of obedience to Jesus Christ as the Lord and to his word. Obedience that is not based on feelings. It's not based on emotions. It's not whether we feel like it. It's a willing sacrifice because we will to do it. We give of ourselves. Because we are totally committed to Jesus Christ, we willingly and sacrificially fulfill the commitments that we've made. As husbands, we will love our wives. Not necessarily because we feel like it, but because of our deep commitment to Jesus Christ, we willingly make the personal sacrifices, whatever it costs us, to love our wives as Christ loved the church. And wives, you respond by lovingly and submitting to your own husbands, not because you necessarily feel like it, but because out of a deep devotion and commitment to Jesus Christ, you seek to obey him and you willingly make the personal sacrifices in order to fulfill the commitment that you've made before God. As children, we willingly honor our parents today, not because they were necessarily great parents or because we feel like them, but because of our deep devotion and commitment to Christ. We honor them because this is pleasing to the Lord. Today, we honor our mothers. Like Dr. Carson, many of us had mothers who had demonstrated throughout their lifetime their commitment to their families and children. I, for one, honor my mom, who's still living, for her commitment to our family and to me, for her love during my childhood years, and her for modeling her commitment to Jesus Christ, and I salute her today. Many of us are married to the mothers of our children. And our wives have demonstrated their commitment to our children and family. And today we rise up to call them blessed, to say thanks for taking their commitment before God seriously, for sacrificially giving of themselves their time, their energy, their resources, their efforts in order to care for and nourish their families. And for most importantly, demonstrating what it means to be committed fully to Jesus Christ, to follow him in life, not based on feelings, but to fulfill the commitments with God's strength and help. And today we salute you. And I salute my dear wife this morning for her demonstrated commitment to our children and for seriously and sacrificially giving for the well-being of my family. And that giving comes from her relationship with Jesus Christ. I thank her today. You know, commitments. Today is a day to honor those who have been our moms. But it's also a day to evaluate the state of our own commitments that we've made. Do we view them as binding? Before God, that no matter what obstacles may be in front of us, that we will keep our side of the commitment. Are we willing to pay the cost that's involved? For every commitment we make, there is a cost. And have we settled that foundational commitment of our life to Jesus Christ as the Lord? Have we come to that place where we've given ourselves to him, our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, as our reasonable service?